Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. State senators plan to vote today on legislation opening state parks and other lands to oil and gas drilling. The revenue from that, in part, is hoped to help pair a $570 million maintenance backlog in the state park system. So how do we fall so far behind, and what are our priorities, and what would close without the extra revenue, if anything? Joining us now is David Payne. He's chief of the Division of Parks and Recreation with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. David has served most recently as director of special projects for the Auditor of State and director of boards and commissions and of constituent affairs for the Office of Governor. Welcome to the show, David.
And thank you very much. It's good to be on with you.
So how do we figure that I thought it was $500 million, but it's $570 million. How do we figure that number in terms of the backlog?
Right. You know, those are deferred critical maintenance projects that we've kind of stacked on top of each other for the last basically 25 years. Some of those are our dams and our shoreline erosion, our water, wastewater treatment systems, camp modernization, our vault restrooms. We have in our parks, in our 75 state parks, we have 505 of the what you would probably call a pit latrine. And, you know, we'd like to modernize those with, flush restrooms. So.
As a camper, I would say yay. but let me ask you, as a camper, how do you prioritize? It sounds like wastewater treatment would be a very high priority.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, we have to have clean water coming in and, clean water going out. So that's critical. So absolutely. But our dams, we have dams around the state that we have to make sure that those are safe. We have earthen dams that we're constantly monitoring. So, there's a lot of priorities. So getting electric into our campgrounds, a lot of our campgrounds, a number of years ago, electric campgrounds had 20 amps, and that was fine, and that could handle them. Now these RVs, you have people pulling in with $500,000 RVs that require, more ampage. And so we'd like to update those to 50 amps that can maintain and hold those folks.
Where does funding for all of these projects come from now?
Right. We get about 50% of our funding from the General Revenue Fund, which means the taxpayers of the state of Ohio. Then the other 50% comes from revenues that we get from renting our cottages and our lodges, golf courses, people attending visiting our campgrounds.
So you mentioned the people in their big RVs. Why?
Yeah.
They're using more. What they need is more, but not everybody benefits from that. What about higher user fees for the things that cost the most?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to keep our state parks affordable. We're only one of seven state parks in the country that just doesn't charge to enter our parks. Now, of course, we charge for camping and staying at our lodges and that type, but we're trying to make our campgrounds and keep them so that all Ohioans and, frankly, visitors from all over the our 50 states and all over the world can come and visit affordably.
You mentioned it's only one of seven, though. Is it unreasonable to maybe think about increasing the fees? Is that at all on the table?
Well, I can tell you that the parks, if you look across the country, the parks that have user fees, they're experiencing difficulties as well. So that's not, that's not the full answer. And again, I think the folks over here at ODNR and at Parks believe that we ought to have our parks, free to the public to come and visit.
My guest is David Payne. He's chief of the Division of Parks and Recreation with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. He's only on with us for a few more minutes, so give us a call if you have a question or comment for David, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, but get those emails in early if you want so we can make sure we can get them on the air. So, David, how do you prioritize at this point? What's at the top of the heap? What has to be done right away?
Well, I mean, if you look at our lodges, we have nine lodges around the state that people visit and stay. You might be familiar with our lodges at Salt Fork and Mohican and Maumee Bay. The majority of our lodges were built in the 70s. And imagine, Ann, if you own a house that you had not done the repairs that you need. Roofs need repaired, our heating, our air conditioning. Those units are the same that we had, 25 years ago. So repairs there. Our cottages were built at about the same time. We have 508 cottages around the state that, again, those need repairs. So what we're trying to do is, prioritize, like you mentioned, and make, make our facilities the best they can be. In 1997, Ohio Parks was voted the best park in the park system in the country, mm-hmm. and we want to maintain that. And we think that visitors this year come out to our parks and enjoy them. But there's a lot of priorities. Absolutely.
I mentioned at the top that State Senate's voting on the legislation that would open the state parks and other state land to oil and gas drilling. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what in that legislation protects the parks from contamination and make sure that there's a proper reclamation and that kind of a thing.
Well, look, I can tell you, oil and gas exploration in our parks is not the end-all, be-all. I mean, it's important. It's one step. I've seen, figures that say we could potentially get revenue from anywhere from $9 to $30 million on leases. Now, it's important. Stewardship is at the top of our list here at Parks and at ODNR, and we have to conserve, we have to preserve, we have to protect and wisely manage our natural resources. That is number one. And then we have to do it safely. So that's the commitment you have from the chief of parks and from the director of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, mm-hmm. David Mustine, that anything we do in regard to oil and gas exploration will be done with stewardship in mind, and it'll be done safely.
Rick in Ravenna, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Yes, Ann, thank you. Good morning. I was just wondering how much money that the state saves by having a company in Baltimore manage all of the reservation services and that type of thing. I do know, as a former person that formerly used the state parks, I got pretty frustrated because I can't get any really direct information about a particular park from this service. Hmm. So to me, it's not really a service. I'm not sure why we're paying somebody out of state, and I'm just wondering what the cost benefit of that is.
David Payne?
Yeah. One of the benefits to our reservation system is that you don't have to show up. If you want reservations on a Saturday night at one of our parks, you don't have to show up on Wednesday to make sure that you're there for Saturday. So it allows our consumers to actually make reservations in advance, 6 months in advance. If you know when you're vacationing, you can make a reservation.
Why does it have to be from an out-of-state company, I guess, and also does it save the state money doing it that
way?
Well,
you know what? We looked at companies here in Ohio to do the reservation system, and frankly, there aren't a lot of folks. We got the lowest bidder, and it was out-of-state, and it's the same company that does our national parks. Mm-hmm. So they know what to look for. And, Rick, I hope you have we're always looking for suggestions on a way to make our reservation system better. So if you have specific items that you would like to address, we'd absolutely like to look at those and make sure that we're providing a good service for our consumers. But we found through our we have a system. If you go to our state parks, there's what we call our blue survey forms, our right forms. Mm-hmm. And people have indicated that they, for the most part, like our reservation system and like the ability to make reservations well in advance and know in advance that they're guaranteed a campsite, a cottage, or a lodge. So it's not guesswork. One of the things a number of years ago that was frustrating to our family, before we got the reservation system, we'd drive all the way up like to Kelly's Island only to find out that they were full. Mm-hmm. But now we know in advance when we make our reservation system that we have a site.
Just going back to the issue of funding, mm-hmm. you were talking about what needs to be done now, and I was wondering about if the $570 million is a big number,
right,
that spans a couple decades now of backlog. What needs to be done this year that's not going to get done? $30 million worth of work, $20 million, $50, $100?
Well, there's $570 million of work that's not going to be done this year. And again, that's marina and dock repairs. That's cottage renovation.
Well, what about shutting things down? Is anything going to have to shut down?
Well, we think that we can, and we're not crying, but and the governor and the legislature has a lot of priorities. And if you look at our budget, for every $100 the government spends in Ohio, 5 cents of it is for parks. But we're not crying, but there's a lot of things that need to be done, and none of those are going to be done. I mean, a lot of these campground renovations are not going to be done. A lot of the wastewater systems are not going to be.
Well, let me ask you this, because they're talking about privatizing toll roads. They're talking about privatizing the lottery. They privatize liquor in the state of Ohio. They want to privatize the at least five of the prisons. What about privatizing state parks and letting private companies operate them, businesses?
And that's something that the governor and the legislature would have to decide. I think that we have done a great job at parks of managing in our parks, and that's something that the legislature would have to decide. But we want to keep our parks open to the public. We have 75 parks, 135 nature preserves around the state that are accessible, and we think as one governor was fond of saying, working harder and smarter and doing more with less. That's kind of our motto. So we're working hard, folks. I'd like to tell everybody that the campgrounds are open, and it's a great thing to do to get out and visit our parks.
Besides the reservation operation out of Baltimore, Maryland, what other things in the park is privatized now? In the parks, what other services are privatized? Anything else?
Yeah, we have our lodges are run by Zantara. Mm-hmm. It's a company that runs. We have some of our concessions are bid out and run by concessionaires, some of our marinas, that type of thing. But, yeah, and our golf courses in some cases.
Okay. I want to try to get one more call in if we can real quick. My guest is David Payne. He's the chief of the Ohio State Park System. It's a division that consists of 75 state parks, canal lands, recreation services, nature preserves, that sort of a thing. So we only have him for about one more minute, and I don't think we're going to be able to get these next calls in. So, David Payne, I just want to say thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it. Would love to be on anytime.
All righty. Thanks.
Thanks.
We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In a check of the weather forecast for central Ohio, today a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly after 5 p.m. this afternoon, though, a high of 77. Then tonight a low of 64 with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. On Thursday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms once again, then partly sunny and a high of 79. Thursday night, a slight chance of rain, low of 64. Looking ahead to Friday, squinting ahead, actually, a slight chance of rain, mostly cloudy, a low of 65. Right now we have 67 degrees at our studios here on the Ohio State University campus. You can listen to 89.7 NPR News anywhere, anytime, by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Live button. It'll link you on the left-hand side of the page. You can listen to local and national news programming online at WOSU.org anytime you'd like to. Get back now to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is Father's Day on Sunday, and with a nod to that, we want to hear from some folks who have memories of their fathers, who have thoughts about fatherhood, and We'll do it via this, I believe. From 1951 to 1955, broadcast journalist Edward R. Murrow created and hosted a popular radio series called This, I Believe, in which people from all walks of life wrote brief essays on the personal philosophies that guided their daily lives. In 2004, longtime radio producer Dan Gettleman, inspired by the original radio series, created a nonprofit organization to engage youth and adults to do the same. More than 90,000 of those essays have been archived on the This I Believe website, broadcast on public radio and featured on weekly podcasts and collected in book form. The newest anthology of 60 essays explores fatherhood, and Dan Gettleman, executive director of This I Believe and the co-editor of This I Believe on Fatherhood, is with us now. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks so much for having me.
How many essays altogether did you cull to come up with these 60?
Hundreds. We started out with, actually by the time we were working on this, we got to over 100,000 essays that were in our archives. And we narrowed it down. We tag all the essays as to topic when they come in. And we narrowed it down to about 300 or so essays on this topic of fatherhood, and then read through them intensely, myself and my two co-editors, John Gregory and my wife, Mary Jo Gettleman. Mm-hmm. And we were looking for as well-rounded a group of essays as possible, looking at all the different facets of fatherhood. So about half the essays are from fathers writing about fatherhood, and then the other half are from people writing about their dads. And then we have a sort of one outlier essay written by a mother about trying to find replacements for an absent father in her children's life.
Yeah, and we happen to have that. Let's see if I can figure out which one it is. It's a Michelle Weldon, and in this excerpt, Michelle Weldon reads from her essay, A Father is Born, from many strangers, about the wonderful teachers, coaches, relatives, and friends who have played a role in the lives of her three sons after their father abandoned them.
No one fills the shoes of a father, but the footprint that the man who fathered them left behind does not have to stay empty. These good men, who are not required to care, but do, convince my sons they are so worthy of being loved.
You said that was an outlier, but you were also surprised at how many essays came from people who were writing about step-parents.
That's right. We had quite a few essays. You know, it is a truism of our time that we have, you know, a high divorce rate and lots of blended families. And so there's a high incidence of people being raised by step-parents. And, you know, step-parents get a pretty bad rap in our culture. You know, you have the wicked stepmother and mm-hmm. certainly several wicked stepfathers in movies and TV shows and books. But it's amazing the number of people who have tremendous things to say about their stepfather. You know, men who have stepped into an awkward situation. Oftentimes, you know, sort of in the middle of the story when a kid is already, you know, partially grown and has this sort of thankless job, you know, all the responsibilities and the costs and everything else involved with being a father, but not necessarily the innate or built-in respect that comes from that role. So, yes, there are quite a few very moving essays from people writing about their stepfathers. And for that matter, looking from the other half of the perspective, you know, fathers who are themselves in non-traditional roles in terms of being fathers.
Another kind of surprising category were fathers who really didn't plan on being fathers. In particular, one was a fellow who they ended up adopting, and he wasn't even sure he wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think this is another truism of modern life, maybe not even modern life, just life in general, that a lot of guys are scared to be fathers. You know, it's not something they feel like it. Either A, it's going to cramp their style, you know, maybe they won't have the attention of their wives, et cetera, or that they're just scared that they'll be bad fathers. You know, maybe they didn't have the best role model themselves, or they just feel like they're not prepared. I don't know too many fathers, frankly, men who become fathers and think, you know what, I can do this in a walk. This is going to be a breeze. But, yeah, we have several reluctant fathers, if you will. And to a man, they write that they grew into the job and that they took great joy in it. And there's one wonderful essay from a guy named David Linvit talking about how his dream for himself was that he was going to have a very adventurous life, maybe be a war correspondent, travel the world, and that he found inexplicably the adventure he was looking for in being a single father of a little girl. And his adventure is finding the lost hamster getting her through a nightmare in the middle of the night or, you know, nursing her through an illness. And, and there's several essays along those lines from fathers who were sort of shocked to find out, A, that they liked it, B, that they were kind of good at it, and C, that they, you know, they were not irreparably ruining their kids' lives through their lack of experience at being a father.
You know, single parenthood was another theme, apart from the whole step-parent issue, that wasn't necessarily up in your face about it, but it tended to be sort of a subplot or very quietly noted in the essays.
Yeah, there's several essays for men who are raising children on their own, either because mom is deceased, mm-hmm. or maybe there's been a divorce or an abandonment. This is becoming a progressively more common experience. You know, I was going to say a century ago, but even 50 years ago, mm-hmm. If fathers found themselves without a wife, without a mother, they would often send the kid to institutional care. There's actually up the road from me where I speak from in Louisville, Kentucky, an orphanage that was mostly filled with kids who had fathers but no mothers. So the idea that today a father would step up and just sort of do the job seems unremarkable. But not too long ago, it would have been unthinkable.
The lengths of the essays seem pretty uniform. What sort of instructions do people get when they're responding to the query for the essays?
Sure. Well, we inherited this series from Edward R. Murrow in the 1950s, who did a series of the same name, and they came up with this format. And it's basically built around the fact that we have a finite amount of time to air these on the radio, as they did back then. And so it works out to be about 500 words. That's the maximum that we give people to write within. And the other parts of what make a This I Believe essay, it needs to be first person. You need to tell what you believe, not what you think the reader ought to believe or listener. It needs to be affirmative. Here's what I do believe, not what I don't believe. And we want you to tell the story behind that belief. Where did it come from? Who taught it to you or inspired you? Maybe a life experience where that belief was tested or confirmed or in some way, shape, or form changed. And so those are the instructions we give to people. But within that, people have complete flexibility in terms of what to do. We've had people send us poems. We've had people send song lyrics. We've had people send tiny little things, you know, like a paragraph or two long. And then we have some people who, you know, expand way beyond the 500 words we ask them and send double that. And we have a lot of editing to do in that case.
When people are responding to the This I Believe, the request from This I Believe, are they doing it to fill a category or do they just write about what is that guiding principle in their life, and it turns out to fall into a category?
That's a really good question. I'm glad you asked it. No, we never tell people what to write about, and it's actually a sort of ironclad rule in our operation. We are a nonprofit organization, by the way, that the call is to write about what is important to you. And for every person who writes one of these, and we have them from elementary school students to nonogenarians, it's all very personal, you know, whatever that particular person finds to be the most important thing in their life or one of the most important things in their life. So what we have done with this book, This I Believe on Fatherhood, and actually we had a book last year called This I Believe on Love, and we have a couple of books coming out in the next year, one on life lessons and one on motherhood for next spring for Mother's Day. So this is our first experiment with
anthologizing them around a particular theme. And we chose fatherhood and then motherhood next year because this is a universal experience. All of us have a father. All of us have a mother. Whether that was a good relationship, a bad one, a short one, a long one, a step relationship, an adoptive relationship, etc., we all have it. And even if we ourselves have not become parents, we at least have the experience of being the child of a parent.
My guest is Dan Gettleman. He's executive director of This I Believe, and he's also co-editor of This I Believe on Fatherhood. It's a new book out. It's a beautiful book. I read it last night and got particularly choked up by reading about this one. Let's listen to Brian McGuire talking about his lifetime of anger toward his alcoholic father and the impact of becoming a father himself.
I sat there in the dark, surrounded by the soothing sounds and smells of my baby's room, and I thought of how Dad must have felt when I was born. I knew at that moment that he never intended to hurt me. I realized that he loved me just as I loved my son. I knew that he had done the best he could, even if it wasn't always very good. I forgave my father that night.
How often do you get the feeling, Dan, that people are kind of cleansed by this process?
Oh, often. I would say, you know, one of the most interesting things that we, the people who work on this, I believe, get to experience, in addition to the awe-inspiring gift of getting to read all of these essays, is that also people send us little notes along with their essays and tell us what it was like to write it. And so many people have written to us and said, this was truly transformative in writing this, or rather in considering what is important to me, and then writing about it. It either confirmed something that had been sort of simmering inside of them, but sort of unspoken and developed, or in the process of thinking about it and writing about it, they learned something from scratch. You know, we've had people tell us that they've changed careers based on writing their This I Believe mm-hmm. essay. They realized, for instance, they were working in the as a military contractor, and that they were pacifists, and they kind of were like, these things don't go together. Or, for instance, in writing about what's really important to them, realizing that they weren't walking that talk in their marriage, in their parenting, in their workplace, in their voting, whatever. So I think, yes, absolutely, that it has had a catalytic, transformative effect on a lot of people. And especially for the people who are writing about being a parent, it's sort of like creating a mission statement for what you're going to be like as a parent and what's important to you. And then maybe it helps you hold yourself to that ideal because you've put it down in writing and, you know, shared it with other people that, you know, I kind of need to do what I said is important to me.
I really love the one about the fellow whose father was a farmer and he had always thought that his father sort of settled.
Mm-hmm. You know, yes, I mean, it's such a common phenomenon.
He made assumptions about his father.
Yeah, it's such a common phenomenon, especially of men of a certain generation, that, you know, maybe they always dreamed of being artists, and then they settled for being a pharmacist and, you know, kind of forgot their dream. And this guy finds out, you know, sort of late in life that his father always dreamed of being a farmer. He wanted to be a farmer. He was living, you know, following his bliss, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that was really sort of like this O. Henry twist in his own life, because he had always assumed his father had just sort of done the right thing, but he really was following the thing that gave him great joy, and in the process sustained the family and, you know, put food on the table.
My guest is Dan Gettleman. He is co-editor of a new book. It's called This I Believe on Fatherhood. It's based on the public radio series This I Believe. If you have a question or comment for Dan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also comment on All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Dan, what about editing? After 30 years in newspapers, I firmly believe everybody needs an editor, but what do you all do with these essays?
Well, we sort of put them in a couple of different classes. If you go on our website at thisibelieve.org, where parenthetically you can find out how to submit your own This I Believe essay and how to write one, we publish all 100,000 of the essays that have been sent to us in their raw form as they came to us from the writer. Mm-hmm. However, for the essays that we put on the radio in particular, and also for the ones that we put directly into books, they go through an editorial process. in particular, and as one who has made the transition from print to radio, maybe you'll understand this more than most people. Writing for the ear is different than writing for the eye. So
yes.
To speak. And we have to take the prose that people have written. First of all, some cases we have to shorten it because it's too long. But in other cases, we ask people to expand upon certain points, or we rearrange it with them, and we suggest maybe that they begin with their ending, or vice versa. In some cases, people write a wonderful story, but it's sort of a little hazy on what the belief is that's involved, and so we ask them to think a little bit about that. But another thing we do is just simply to make it roll off the tongue. So, for instance, a lot of times people write correctly the way they were taught in school without any contractions, but when you and I speak, we say I'm and not I am, or, you know, don't mm-hmm. instead of do not, little things like that. We don't rewrite it for them. We just try to help them make it better, if you will. And for the most part, they really appreciate the experience. For a lot of these folks, they're not published writers. They've never been through an editorial process before, and they're intrigued by the whole thing. So it's been a very rewarding experience for us, and we hope for them.
Let's listen to one more essay before we take a quick break. This excerpt, Johnny Barmore explains how her father's love of fishing became a source of wisdom in later life, especially in her role as a mental health therapist for children.
When my sister died unexpectedly at the age of 17, I remember feeling like I could not breathe. Everyone in our large family was grieving terribly. I remember my father got up early the next day to go fishing alone. It was his way of coping, and everyone understood. I never saw him cry about my sister. I often wondered if the fish did. I have a mental picture of him pouring his heart out to a wide-eyed bluegill who listened sympathetically before swimming away.
Were you sometimes amazed by the creativity that people brought to the project?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, before I forget, Johnny Barmore is a Buckeye from Cincinnati.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that having to write an essay with a maximum of 500 words does to a writer is sort of make them more poetic. There's a lot more metaphor. There's a lot more color. There's a lot more care in the writing. That we actually did a book event here in Louisville last night, and there were two essays, one of them from Cincinnati. And this one fellow, who's a published writer, has written several novels. It took him 18 months to write his essay.
Right.
He just kept doing one edit after another and one draft after another and paring it down and getting it to that sort of, again, poetry. And for someone like Johnny writing about the fishing almost as metaphor for her relationship with her father and also literally the way that she found communion with him, it's not a completely uncommon thing. In the essays we receive.
Coming up, we're going to meet one of the essayists featured in the book, Susan Kramer of Granville. She's with us now, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Coming up next hour on All Sides with Ann Fisher, Lake Erie water use and regulation. The guests will include Patricia Burkholz, who's the director of the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes. Also, Brian Barger, attorney for Bradley Coyle and Schmidt. And Josh Knights, the executive director of the Nature Conservancy in Ohio. That's all coming up in hour number two of today's All Sides with Ann Fisher. The weather forecast, chance of showers and thunderstorms mainly after 5 p.m. today. High of 77 otherwise. Chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, low of 64. Thursday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms and partly sunny. The high tomorrow should be around 79, with a chance of rain Thursday night and a slight chance of showers on Friday, a high of 75.
I'm WSU General Manager Tom Ryland. While we don't know how the funding battle in Washington or the State House will end, we know you've got the power to strengthen and support 89.7 NPR News. Our fiscal year-end goal was $500,000, and we now need to raise $120,000 to reach that goal by June 30th. We thank everyone who has contributed in recent weeks. Do your part with a gift at WOSU.org or by calling us at 866-897-9678.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Unitarian Universalist Congregations, taking part in the Pride Parade Saturday, June 18th, and having services Sunday the 19th, where all are welcome. More information at centralohiou.info.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a new book. It's called This I Believe on Fatherhood. And, of course, it's based on the series, the radio series. You've heard it on public radio. You've heard it on WOSU. It's called This I Believe. And our guest is Dan Gettiman. He's the executive director of This I Believe, Inc. It's a nonprofit organization and also the co-editor of the anthology of essays, This I Believe on Fatherhood. Joining us now is one of the essayists featured in the book, Susan Kramer of Granville. Susan is a member of the Board of Trustees of the Granville Public Library, and she's an advisor to the middle school's creative writing club, Power of the Pen. That's also a competition I've judged in the past. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Why did you decide to write an essay in the first place?
Well, as I said in my essay, my mother and stepfather came to visit us in Ohio the winter before he died, and he really did come to say goodbye because he knew that he was going to be dying soon. And I watched him say goodbye to his grandson, who happened to be in third grade at the time. And I hadn't set this up. I just was sitting in a place where I could watch all of the emotions cross his face as he said goodbye to this little boy who just adored him and he adored in turn. And I walked around for months with that picture burned on my retinas, and I couldn't get it out of my head, and I couldn't get past it, and I just was so, so sad. So I sat down to write this piece, and it's just amazing how cathartic an exercise like that is.
So did you write it for This I Believe, or did you write it and then submit it to This I Believe? When, I mean, how did that process work?
I wrote it because the picture in my brain was driving me crazy.
But were you prompted by This I Believe?
That's no, what I guess. Absolutely
okay.
Not.
You wrote it anyway.
I wrote it to just get sane.
And so how did you submit it to This I Believe then?
Well, that was really funny. I was I got to a point in my writing career where I was tired of writing advertising. And I was looking for opportunities to be published. And, you know, you go to the library, you look in Writer's Market, you look for contests, you keep your ears open. You know, you understand that as a beginning writer, you're not going to get the biggest agent and get your novel right off the bat. So you look for smaller ways to get your feet into the industry. And I think this was at the very time that Rick Warren was asking for essays for his Purpose-Driven Life project, and This I Believe was asking for essays as well. So I sent it to both, and you know, you send your essay out in cyberspace, and that's the last you hear about it.
What did you think when they suggested or they asked you if they could put it into the anthology?
Oh my gosh, that is kind of a funny story, because I'd heard nothing for years, and the first two volumes came out, and I'd read them and said, well, I guess that's, mine's this good, but, you know, whatever. So to step back a little, my husband and I were packing my son to go to college. And we've been very involved parents. He's a great kid. And we were very sad that he was leaving for college. And we were a little bit angry because he wasn't sad. You know, he was plowing into this great adventure. And we're like, well, can't you just understand the bittersweet nature of this? So he's like, let's go, let's go. So we're packing the car, and it's a hot day, and we're sweating, and we're arguing. And I finally got disgusted and said, I've had it with you two people. I'm going upstairs to check my email. And on my email was a message from This I Believe saying that they wanted to include my essay in their book on fatherhood. And I think my boys heard me screaming from the outside, so they came running in. But the great part of the story was we were taking our son to college the very next day, where his first official college function was going to be a discussion of the summer reading project, This I Believe.
Dan, something Susan said made me think, do you ever get people calling you up saying, hey, why ain't you haven't you published one of my essays?
Oh, sure. No, we get emails and calls every day. You know, if we had our druthers, we would be publishing a book, a week and putting all these essays in. And actually, we are working towards doing a quarterly magazine that will include, essays. So we're trying very hard to get more of these out there. You know, before I forget, because sure. You told that story, this, I believe, is used in many, many schools all over the country, including at WOSU, at OSU, the university, where there's a whole bunch of students that have a program called Buckeyes Are Believing.
Right.
Where they all write these This I Believe essays, so it's been really quite remarkable. If there are any educators listening today, we have on our website at thisibelieve.org, in addition to information on how you can get This I Believe on Fatherhood, curricula for middle school, high school, college, and adult learning curricula. So just wanted to mention that before I forget.
It's such a departure from what I did on my summer vacation.
Well, it is, and about half of the essays we've received all come from people under the age of 18 who are, for the most part, doing this because it's a classroom assignment. And it has been so interesting to read. One of the things we're working on is a book of essays from young people, and so many of them have said to us, me in the flesh and also via email, this is the best, writing assignment I've ever been given. Normally in school, they want me to tell them what they believe or what I read in the book or what the teacher lectured. But to ask me what I believe and what I think, well, that's something different. And students really embrace it. And a lot of teachers have told us that their kids have really risen to the occasion and written great things.
Let's hear Susan Kramer read from her essay. It's called The Measure of a Man, and it's about her stepfather. Susan.
Thank you. He came to Ohio to say goodbye the winter before he died. We pretended that it was a regular visit, although we all knew that he and my mother never left the mountain during ski season. And except for the added layers of clothing he wore because the radiation treatments made him constantly cold, he was as he'd always been, smacking his lips over a few bites of a candy bar and wrapping up the rest for later, and reading to the bottom of the menu, even after ordering, just to make sure he hadn't missed anything wonderful. Together, we watched the news, visited a local museum, went out for dinner. The day they left, we had his favorite breakfast. He ate each of his tiny pancakes with a different flavored dollop of syrup. Grandpa, how come you eat your pancakes like that? Don't you have a favorite? I have so many favorites, I can never pick just one. There's a lot of great stuff out there, Chief. I have come to believe in my stepfather's formula for a rich and happy life, to be individual enough to wear clothing that will embarrass your children, to be open enough to experience everything life has to offer, from 6 different flavors of pancake syrup to a paddleboat cruise on the Mississippi, and to have the grace to help someone else fly down the mountainside. It seems to me that the true measure of a man is not the car in which he drives through life, but the size of the hole left behind when he leaves it. I believe that greatness can be accomplished through small as well as monumental deeds, and that average people, like my stepfather, can make a big difference in small ways.
Susan, when you read that, does it still move you?
It still does. And it is very much him. It's very much him.
I love the line, and you and I looked at each other as you said it, that and reading to the bottom of the menu even after ordering just to make sure he hadn't missed anything wonderful.
My stepfather had the admirable and unique ability to wring the most possible joy from life's small and mundane moments. He enjoyed a trip to the grocery store. A few bites of his favorite candy bar could make him happy for the next few minutes. He just really got everything out of life that a person can get, I think.
In preparing to read this, how did you change it to read it versus how it was written?
I've been walking around the house reading it out loud for days, and trying to put in the pauses where I needed them and with the understanding that sentence fragments would be acceptable. So I'm a firm believer in reading out loud, even for the written word. When I work with my students, I make them hand each other their stories so that nobody reads their own work, so they get to hear what works and what doesn't work. So.
Dan Gettleman, how do you prepare folks to read on the air?
Well, we do quite a bit, actually. We, especially for people who have never done any performing or public speaking, you know, they can be very shy, and people tend to be very monotone when they read, and so, you know, there's a lot of little tricks of the trade, one of which is to get people to do jumping jacks, you know, really, and just to get physically, you know, warmed up. Vocal exercises like you would for a singer, get people to, you know, just kind of do glissandos up and down with their voice. And, you know, oftentimes we have people do two and three takes. And for the most part, people have tendencies to either read too fast or too slow. And so getting that sort of Goldilocks, you know, perfect medium between the two is a bit of a challenge. But, you know, by and large, people want to do a good job. And so we just, in the same way that, you know, our approach to editing their essay is to just sort of try to bring out the best in it, we're also trying to bring out the best in their reading.
You know, sometimes when I'm reading something like this, if I had to read it out loud, even though I hadn't written it, it would be difficult for me. And I know I'm not a pro like you. I've only been doing this a couple of years. But it's hard to talk about something so emotional and recite it that way.
Well, we did we had an event here in Louisville last night with two essayists reading their essays, and both of them broke down reading their essays. Both happened to be writing about, like Susan, deceased parents. And, you know, that's just a hard thing to do in public, you know, especially sometimes years afterwards. You know, it just, you know, both of these people had the same experience Susan did, where they wrote their essay several years ago, and then we contacted them years later to put them in this book, and it was sort of like reliving it all over again.
Yeah, how many years went by, Susan?
I think it was about two.
About 2 years?
Yeah, it was a while.
And Dan, you've been doing this since 2004?
2005,
okay.
We have some essays in the book that go all the way back to 2005. So for some of these people, it was quite a challenge, actually, to go back and edit their essays, because they had to kind of put themselves back in time. Like, in some cases, you know, completely different things have happened in their life. You know, in one of our other books, we had this book of essays on love, and this man is writing beautiful things about his wife, and of course they've divorced since then, and he, you know, and he's like, well, can I change it, you know?
And what do you do in those kind of cases?
Well, in some cases, if it's irreparable and they just don't want to go through the, you know, they it really bothers them, we just move on and we find somebody else to work with. But for the most part, people accept that these are moments in time that are captured in these essays, and that in the same way that you wouldn't go back and edit a journal entry that you wrote 5 years ago, it's sort of not right to revisit history and change what you were feeling and thinking and writing, you know, 5 years before. So for the most part, people have been able to get behind that concept, and in that case, we're just sort of cleaning up, you know, grammar and punctuation and stuff, and otherwise leaving it alone.
Well, speaking of moments in time, let's listen to another one of my favorites. Corey Harbaugh reads from his essay, Truth and the Santa Claus Moment, about the power of a moment. In this case, the moment when his 8-year-old son asks, Dad, if I asked you if it was you who brought presents at Christmas instead of Santa, would you tell me?
I turned to my son and was able to finally look into his big eyes. Tucker, your question was, if you asked me about Santa, would I tell you? And my answer is yes. If you ask, I will tell you. He considered this a moment, smiled, and before he drank the last swallow of soda pop, he told me easily, Then I'm not going to ask. That was good enough for both of us. For now. There will be other questions like this to come, no doubt. They, too, will have their moments.
Dan, do you have any favorites?
Well, actually, that right there, Corey Harbaugh's, is one of my favorite essays in the book, and we chose to lead the book with it. Just because, I mean, it is at once well-written and funny, but so true. Every single parent that I know of has had to, you know, or if they haven't already, they will have to deal with this challenge. What happens when your kid says, what about the tooth fairy, you know? Was that you or mom or the tooth fairy or my pillow? And, you know, you're... you have this dilemma. Do you lie? Do you tell the truth? Do you kick the can down the road until next year? What do? Do you say, go ask your mom, you know? So Corey, I think, just did this beautiful thing with this, as did his son. You know?
Yeah, because it's the way he asked the question.
Yeah.
If I ask, he's, and one of the points Corey made in it is he asked actually him several questions at once.
Right.
Would you tell me if I asked you?
Right, right. Well, I think that's the thing, is that kids, you know, they want to hold on to that mystery and that, you know, that fantasy for a while, but they also want to know that their parents are reliable, you know, and so I think the two of them did that dance beautifully, and I couldn't imagine doing it any better. And, you know, I've got 9-year-old twins, and we went through this a couple of years ago with them where they were, you know, one of them was starting to question the Santa Tooth Fairy thing, and the other one wasn't. So it's like, well, now, wait a second. What happens if one infects the other one and ruins it for them? And it all worked out, you know. But, you know, there's some, you know, the first time you experience any of these challenges as a parent, and this is borne out in the book, you know, it's confusing, you know. Am I going to inadvertently do something that's going to ruin my kid's life here if I, you know, do it wrong? And, you know, one of the lasting things from these essays from fathers who have been around the block a little bit is, you know what? I can do this. This is doable. You know, maybe my father didn't do this with me, but I can punt. I can learn how to make the kids lunch and breakfast and, you know, go to the PTA meeting and do these things that modern dads did that perhaps their father's generation never did. Anyway, it's been a wonderful experience editing this book and getting a chance to read all of these essays and get to know some of these essayists. And I hope your listeners will partake in this book, which, by the way, of course, makes a wonderful gift for Father's Day.
It certainly does. It's called This I Believe on Fatherhood. It's edited by my guest, Dan Gettleman, and also with John Gregory and Mary Jo Gettleman. Dan Gettleman is inspired by the original radio series brought to us by journalist Edward R. Murrow. It's called This I Believe. There's a website you can go to, and you can hear broadcasts. You can also hear weekly podcasts, and there are other books as well. What's the next one coming up, Dan?
The next one coming up will be this fall. It's called This I Believe, Life Lessons. Come out in October, and then next April, This I Believe on Motherhood.
All right. Well, thanks again, Dan, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's Dan Gettleman, executive producer of This I Believe, and also Susan Kramer from Granville, one of the essayists in This I Believe on Fatherhood. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Anne. It's been great.
Susan Kramer, she is a member of the Board of Trustees of the Granville Public Library. She's also an advisor to the middle school's creative writing club, Power of the Pen. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.